Good, so welcome if you've just joined us in the second half. Today's an auspicious day, it's Dharma Day. And as Maitreya Bandhu said, we're going to have a full moon puja to celebrate Dharma Day after the class. But it's auspicious also, I feel, because Padma Vajra is with us this evening. I'm very, very, very happy that Padma Vajra is here at the London Buddhist Centre. Padma Vajra used to live at the London Buddhist Centre. He helped build...
Sort of.
The London Buddhist Centre. So he was there at the very, very start of the LBC. And particularly, I don't know, when I meet all the members who were here at the start and who were part of those conditions that led to the building of this centre, the founding of this centre, I feel a lot of gratitude because my life has been tremendously enriched. Well, that puts it too vaguely, too mildly. By the efforts of all those people who put so much into it in building this place. But Padma Vajra's currently, one for quite a number of years, he's been living at Padmaloka Retreat Centre, which is a men's retreat centre in Norfolk. Many of you will know it and be very familiar with it. It's a place where men who are training to join the Sri Ratna Buddhist Order can go on retreat, and all the ordination training retreats for men in most of Europe happen at Padmaloka. So it's a very, very key place for men in our movement and in our order, and Padma Vajra's been a driving force at Padmaloka for many, many, many years. He's. I was thinking of what to say about Padma Vajra, and there's much that I could say. But what immediately comes to mind is, the word love. It's Maitri. It's Maitri. It's metta. But sometimes we think of metta in very sort of kind of cool terms. And when I think of Padma Vajra, it's not cool. It's passionate love.
It's cool.
It's Maitri in that with a capital M. That's one of his most outstanding qualities. He's a man of great passion, of great love. He has a great love for the Dharma. He has a great love and devotion to our teacher Bhante Sangharakshita. And he has a great love for many, many, many people that he's befriended in our order and movement. I feel fortunate, blessed to be one of the people that he's befriended. It has made my life richer, knowing Padma Vajra. It's, I feel... sort of very fortunate to be in the same order as men like Padma Vajra. He's an exemplar. He's an exemplar of a Dharma practitioner. He really, really is. And he was ordained at the age of 19. He spent all of his adult life in the movement and order. Today, I mean, we were talking about some of the young men who have just been on the young men's intensive, I was saying not specifically, but that we've had a lot of young men. And our young people's activities are for the under 35s, aren't they? And Padma Vajra was ordained at 19. He came along to the Dharma at 17, is that right? At 17. And responded immediately the first time he came along. He talks about, or maybe he'll talk more about that. Maybe we can encourage him to talk more about what it was like in those early days. But yes, he's a friend to many, many people. A friend, he's a Kalyana Mitra, a spiritual friend to many, many people, myself included. And he does that with, not just with great kindness, but with a great deal of wisdom and interest. When you're with Padma Vajra, he makes you feel like you're the only person that he's interested in, and he's interested in whatever you're interested in, and I feel like it's sort of basking in sunshine when I'm in Padma Vajra. Today we've spent a few hours together, and it was like there was a sun out there, and then there was a sun of Padma Vajra, and that you can't help but just blossom and bloom and open up when you're in his presence. That's how I feel, and I know many, many people in our movement and order feel a lot of gratitude to Padma Vajra. Tonight we've asked him to talk about friendship, spiritual friendship, and particularly about Bhante Sangharakshita, because Padmavaj was known Bhante for so many years. Bhante ordained Padmavajra, and he has a great devotion. Padmavajra is a true disciple. He has a great devotion for Bhante. And these days, many of us are unlikely to have very much direct contact with Bhante. But what we can do is have contact with those who had contact with Bhante. And I think that's a real boon. It's a gift that Padmavajra can give, another gift that he can give in our ordinary movement. So the reason we've asked him to talk about friendship and Bhante is because we've been exploring Triratna in a series of weeks, well, starting last week, and we've got a number of weeks exploring what the Triratna community is about. And one of the things it's about is friendship, Kalyan Mitrata. Last week, I wasn't here, but Subhadramathi was telling me that she was asking people what they wanted to know about Triratna. And somebody talked about, or wanting to know about, Bhante and his role. And I can't think of a better person to talk about Bhante Sangharakshita. Can't think of a better person to talk about Kalyan Mitrata, about spiritual friendship, about Maitri, about love, and the place of love, than Padmavajra. So let's give him a very, very warm hand.
The coming of love is mysterious as the flight of a bird from unknown lands. It's going mysterious as the unseen tumult of the wind blowing we know not whither. What is this mystery of love that has opened in my heart like a bud at midnight and sends its sweetness crying through the dark like the voice of one mad with desire? Strange it is, strange indeed, that shooting up through the crevices of my heart unfolds itself ever whiter and whiter, the pale green lily of love. If the flower of love blooms not within the garden of my heart, with what shall I come in my hands to worship thee, O Lord? Bring flowers, bring lights, bring incense, O fools that do not know the holiness of love. So that's the first five verses of a long poem written by Sangharakshita between 1950 and 1953, called The Veil of Stars, which he wrote in India, very much under the influence of Rabindranath Tagore. Very much under the influence of Rabindranath Tagore's Stray Birds. These very short, aphoristic poems, which added up to a sort of story. And it's a very intense story, and a bit, I think, presumably after he wrote this long set of poems, he wrote an argument which was prefixed to The Veil of Stars. And it's very much a platonic poem, and what it's describing is the poet falling intensely in love with someone, and that love is not reciprocated, even though a friendship forms between them, but it's not reciprocated in the way the lover, the poet, wishes it to be. And he has to go to nature to deal with this unrequited, unreciprocated love. And over time, over a whole process of time, all sorts of insights, all sorts of visions, there's this transformation of love, or desire, into, as he puts it, desire for anyone becomes love for someone and blossoms into compassion for all sentient beings. And it's a very, very beautiful poem. I didn't actually know about it until about 1979, when Sangharakshita's collected poems came out in a sort of cyclist-styled edition. But I was so pleased to read this long poem. And it's, I guess, one of the reasons why I'm a disciple of Sangharakshita, because in Sangharakshita's teaching, you have to have love. There has to be, as he puts it more prosaically, emotional equivalence to intellectual understanding. Love and desire has to be transformed onto the path. This might be a bit of a surprise to some people who've maybe read Sangharakshita's various prose writings and listened to his lectures, and very often people will sort of mention the clarity, the scholarship, the great practicality, the great common sense. But in the poetry, which isn't everybody's cup of tea, there is enormous intensity. Enormous intensity of feeling and emotion. He says there's things he can say in poetry that he can't say any other way. Whether or not it's good or bad poetry is another point, but this is where he expresses his most intense feelings. And over the years, he certainly talked about the main issue of the spiritual life, of the Dharma life, is to engage our desire, to engage our emotion, to engage our love. I was very struck by your introduction, which was very generous, very kind. And Gnanavacha didn't know he was going to start reading from this poem. I don't think he knew I was going to talk immediately about this. But this whole way of looking at the Dharma life, the spiritual life, is music to me, because I think my whole way of approaching the Dharma life is definitely via love. It's definitely via desire. I might talk a bit more about that later. Around the same time that he wrote this sequence of poems, The Veil of Stars, he wrote an essay called The Good Friend, an editorial for his magazine of Himalayan Buddhism called Stepping Stones, this wonderful magazine that he ran pretty much single-handed in Kalimpong, this obscure border town in West Bengal. And The Good Friend is a really wonderful article, and I'd really recommend that you read it. It's in a collection now called Crossing the Stream, and it's a lot of Sangharakshita's very, very early writings, some of which I think he wrote even before he was ordained as a Buddhist monk. And actually you find some of his most abiding insights, some of the most freshest way of putting things in his really early work. And actually you can see that his insights were all, you know, formed very, very early on, and they've been sort of worked out over the years. But there's a freshness, a purity, a kind of innocence, I guess, and a sort of power about some of this early writing that is really well worth reading. But in The Good Friend, I think it's here that he first talks about the fact that, you know, human beings are desiderative. We are creatures of desire. It's not ideas that move us. Ideas are important, of course, but in the end, it's our desires that make us do things. It's our desires that make us get out of bed in the morning. It's our desires that in the end are going to make a difference to whether or not we, you know, meditate in the morning or whatever it might be. We're driven by our desire. We're driven by our emotion. We are volitional creatures. And he talks about, yes, so what is the emotional equivalent to the great Buddhist doctrine of anatman? Anatman means something like the fact that there's no fixed and unchanging self. This is an absolutely fundamental Buddhist teaching, that on analysis we won't find any abiding selfhood in our experience. Selfhood is an ever-changing flow of conditioned arising. So the emotional equivalent to that realization, the emotional equivalent to that idea, is friendship, is maitri. So if you really do have an insight into not self, the expression will be in love. Not attached love, not sexual love, but friendly love. Love which is opening out. Love which is open-handed. Love which doesn't really desire in the end reciprocation. Love which serves. He talks about how in friendship, in real friendship, there is mutual service. When friends love each other, they give to each other without expectation of reward. And he talks about the different levels of friendship, and he talks particularly about the friendship towards a Kalyana Mitra, a spiritual friend more experienced than ourselves, and how you can have a sort of life of service to a spiritual friend, and even saying that there are even Kalyana Mitras beyond the sort of human spiritual friend in the form of the Bodhisattvas, the Buddha, if you like, the higher spiritual friend. So from this point of view, you can see why the Buddha says the whole of the Dharma life, not the half of the Dharma life, the whole of the Dharma life is found in spiritual friendship. It's all about a life of service to our friends. Our friends on the same sort of level of us as ourselves, our friends who are less experienced than ourselves, and yes, our friends who are greater than us. It's all about that. All of our Dharma practice can be seen in those terms. And that's, yes, what I've been asked to talk about. But I do want to make that point. In a way, Jnanavacha made it very well when talking about me, which, you know, I'm not sure if it's, well, I mean, it's Jnanavacha's greatness, I think, that he sort of sees these things. But we're not, when we talk about friendship, we aren't talking about anything sort of tepid and cool. I think that's really important. The kind of friendship that Sangharakshita is talking about, the kind of friendship that the Buddha is talking about, yes, it does have that, as it were, disinterested quality, in the sense that you're not trying to get something back from your friend. But it's definitely hot. It's definitely passionate. It's a passionate interest in others. That's the kind of friendship that he's evoking, that he's talking about. And also long-lasting. In fact, you know, if a friendship dies, it's probably not really a friendship anyway. I think the great Christian Alred of Rivo, who wrote a wonderful treatise on friendship, which I became aware of through Sangharakshita, through my teacher, he says friendship should have a quality of eternity to it. Friendship should sort of mirror eternity, in that it never dies. And if friendship does die, it never really was friendship in the first place. Friendship should have this, be this reflection of the timeless. It's a wonderful insight into friendship. And we know very well when a friendship dies or goes wrong, how terribly painful that is. And perhaps it's because there is a sort of loss of that eternal, timeless dimension in our lives. So friendship should also have that quality, yes, not just of passion and intensity, but we're looking for that quality of eternity in friendship, not just being defined by proximity, not being defined by change of circumstance, not being defined by change of mood, change of behaviour, but remaining faithful, constant, all the time to what is good in one another. Years ago, Sangharakshita gave a wonderful lecture called Fidelity, which he pronounced for some reason as Fidelity, I don't quite know why, and just talked about what an incredibly important quality fidelity and faithfulness is. Which doesn't mean by that attachment. Fidelity is something else. Jnanavacha mentioned our time together today, and I've also had time this weekend with Maitreya Bandhu and Maitreya Raja and Jed and Glenn and various other people, and bumping into old friends who were here this evening and who were here yesterday. And it's curious because it's not like starting again. It's never like starting again. It's not even necessarily that, you know, they're on my mind all the time, but because we share the same teacher, but because we're part of the same Dharma, because we're living the same life, a sort of transcendent life, I guess, or an aspiration to that, it's just like carrying on. It's just like picking up again, not in a way where we left off the last time we saw each other. It's a bit hard to describe. But I think that's one of the wonderful sort of mysteries of friendship. Yes, it has that quality of faithfulness and eternity to it. And I think you get that especially when you live a life of friendship and community around something higher and greater than yourselves. And so long as you're not having expectations of what others should give you, it will carry on flowing in that kind of way. As soon as your expectations sort of come in about what the other should give you, then you're in for dukkha, and it ceases to be a spiritual community. It becomes much more of a sort of group characterized by a clamoring for rights rather than the joy of service and duty. So I've learnt these things from Sangharakshita. I've learnt these things that I'm saying from Sangharakshita, both from things he said to me and in different groups down the ages and in different lectures, and through personal experience, through being with him, through seeing him. And I think the rest of this talk, I think it would be best if, rather than me going on and on about friendship, is to say something about him, because he's sort of much more interesting, I think, than I am, and anything I could say, really. But where to begin? How to begin? I think one of the things I need to say, first of all, you come to this wonderful centre, and we have this Tree Ratna Buddhist order, and it all seems very developed, and maybe even some people think of it as a sort of religious order or a religious organisation, and Sangharakshita is this sort of kind of head figure, you know, maybe even people think he's a sort of pope or something like that, I don't know, or whatever way you might think. It's really not like that. It's really not like that. It's incredibly important to keep that in mind. And when I think we come into something that's very well articulated and organised, which is a wonderful thing, and I don't think that's a bad thing. I think, you know, sometimes people get nostalgic about the old days of the Tree Ratna. You might hear stories and you think, wow, that sounds great. I tell you, this is great. I mean, now is better than ever. You have to remember that in the early days, we were all young. I mean, 17, 19, early 20s, etc. And when you kind of get young people like that together, what do? They compete. They take great chunks out of one another. They're not very kind to each other. You know, we were appalling to one another in many, many ways, and sometimes living in sort of squalor as well. So I'm not nostalgic. I mean, I generally find the spiritual community these days far more interesting, far more friendly, with a much greater sort of variety and richness to it. So when I talk about the old days, don't sort of think, wow, that was so much better, I wish I was around then. You might not have lasted. I mean, it's a miracle. I mean, to be honest, it's a miracle that some of us are sort of still standing from the old days. I tell you, you know, we really were extraordinarily sort of heroic, I think, to sort of keep going. Well, no, that's a bit of a joke. So, all right, so what was it like for me when I first came along? Well, I first came along, I lived in a small village called Hassocks, if any of you know it, in West Sussex, near Brighton. I had a very curious mind. I was hopeless at school. I was more or less thrown out of school when I was 16. I was sort of unteachable, really. I just didn't get it, you know, the importance of study and all that sort of thing. But I had a very curious mind, always sort of exploring stuff to do with, you know, particularly the sort of weirdest music I could find at that time. I won't go into the details of that. And wide reading. But eventually it got me through to reading Buddhism, particularly Tibetan Buddhism. And the first Buddhist book I read when I was about 17 was a book called Foundations of Tibetan Mysticism by Lama Anagarika Govinda, which I thought was absolutely fantastic. Incredible. Didn't understand a word of it, but I'm one of these people that actually like books that they don't understand. And even nowadays, I read books. I love a book that I don't understand. Lots of obscure knowledge, footnotes, bliss. Fantastic. Really love books like that. It's not just because I can sort of surprise you with obscure knowledge, not just. But anyway, I love that book, and I definitely got something out of it. I got, first of all, spiritual life without God. Brilliant. No creator, no limitation. Fantastic. Higher states of consciousness described, attainable through meditation. Yes, you can have that bliss. You can have that expansive consciousness. You can have that ecstasy without acid. You know, I've done a bit of that, all that kind of thing. No, you can do it. Find a guru, learn meditation. Then I read his Way of the White Clouds, Lama Govinda's Way of the White Clouds. I didn't know, by the way, that Lama Govinda was a friend of Sangharakshita, because I didn't know about Sangharakshita in those days. Way of the White Clouds, it was a kind of spiritual seeker, a romantic spiritual seeker's Bible, really. It's all about Lama Govinda's journeys in the Himalayas and in Tibet to meeting his gurus. And he describes initiation. He describes the initiation he gets from his teachers. You know, something happens. There's a transmission. There's a transmission of energy, of power. And he's off. He's into visionary experience. And I thought, yes, I want a teacher. I want that. I mean, I think at the back of it, there was this idea that, you know, I didn't really want to work or anything like that. So I think there was something a little bit dodgy. You know, you find a teacher who does something to you, and then you're off. Very attractive. I must admit, I'm still a bit like that. I'm still sort of in that sort of groove. Anyway, so I've got to find a teacher. Well, 1974, a housing estate in Hassocks. You don't find gurus in the Yellow Pages. You don't even find the Brighton Buddhist Centre. There wasn't a Brighton Buddhist Centre in those days. And I was actually getting desperate. I remember going on a fantastic family holiday to Cornwall, where I was, you know, left on my own quite a lot. And I kind of entered this sort of timeless zone. It was the particular place that we were staying in, which is all associated with ley lines and all that. And I remember coming off that holiday feeling really quite depressed, because my head was full of Lama Govinda, and I needed a teacher. And I remember sitting cross-legged in my bedroom, desperate to find a teacher. Anyway, one day I went to the hippie shop that I used to frequent in Brighton, the nearby town, and there was this little handwritten card saying, "The Friends of the Western Buddhist Order," that was the old name for the Tree Ratna, which I thought, well, that's a really boring name, isn't it? They're actually not proper Buddhists, they're just sort of friends of Western Buddhists. Anyway, but they're Buddhists. They're thinking of starting a centre. Contact this address. So I immediately went there, and these very, very nice people in this private house said, come back next week. There's an order member here named Buddhadasa. Wow, you know, is he Tibetan? he's on an order day. Come back next week and you can get into things. So that next week I was full of longing. I was going to meet my teacher. Maybe I'd get that initiation and so on. Well, it was a little bit disappointing, because Buddhadasa turned out to be English. Actually, he's Welsh, but he sounds very English. Jeans, jumper, you know, friendly. But, you know, he didn't sort of immediately recognise me as, you know, an outstanding spiritual seeker. I was a bit disappointed. The first class I went to was a 50-minute metta-bhavana, followed by the Sevenfold Puja. I mean, no gentle sort of beginner's entry in those days. But by the end of the puja, I knew that I was going to devote my life to Buddhism. I knew I was going to be an order member. I didn't even know what it was. But I knew. I don't know how I knew, but I knew. It was a bit like that falling in love, actually. I really felt that I'd found what I was looking for, which is a little bit peculiar, I think, at age 17, to do that. Eventually, very quickly, I left home and I moved into, by that time, Buddhadasa had got together the first Brighton Buddhist Centre. And I also discovered Sangharakshita, and initially on reel-to-reel tape, this shows how long ago it was, in his lectures. And these lectures, they must have been things like the Eightfold Path series. They had a very, very big effect on me. Eightfold Path, Higher Evolution, lecture series given in the 60s. And then eventually the Tantric series, Creative Symbols of the Tantric Path to Enlightenment. And one of the things that struck me, even coming through this reel-to-reel tape, was energy. And Sangharakshita was in the late 60s, early 70s, Sangharakshita's energy was really, really very, very strong indeed. You can sort of see it in his memoirs. You know, he was in his 40s or something like that. And you can hear a man in his prime and even hear him sort of banging the table and the microphone sort of shaking. So this was coming through. And I was reading whatever books I could read of Sangharakshita's, Survey of Buddhism, Essence of, and there weren't many books. And hearing Buddhadasa talk about Sangharakshita, and I thought, this is my guru, okay? And then the Tantric Path series, again, is full of this. There's a wonderful lecture called The Cosmic Refuge Tree and the Archetypal Guru, which is all about, it's got a lot about Padmasambhava in, who I connected with quite early. And there's a description of Guru Yoga, where you transform yourself into a red goddess, a Dakini called Vajrayogini, and you imagine your teacher above your head, then Padmasambhava, then the 11-headed and 1,000-armed Avalokiteshvara, then Amitabha, and then with intense yearning you invoke the gurus, eventually dissolving them down into you and transforming yourself into the light of absolute overwhelming ecstasy. Yes! Yeah, so even on a reel-to-reel tape, something would be coming through listening to this stuff, right? So I got very excited. And Sangharakshita was coming. He'd been in New Zealand, where he'd been to see our centres in New Zealand, and after coming back from New Zealand, he wanted to see the Brighton Buddhist Centre, because it was after Glasgow, it was after North London and Glasgow, the original North London Centre in Archway, this was the first centre that had been opened. And I have to say, here it is again, my guru is coming, right? My teacher is coming. Sangharakshita is going to be my teacher. And this is going to be it. Now, it was Chogyam Trungpa in one of his books says that the relationship between a teacher and a disciple in relation to a teacher, is continuing disappointment. One of the things that the teacher does is continually disappoint the expectations of the disciple. And I remember reading Trungpa on that, and I thought, I don't like the sound of that. I think he must be wrong. But you're going to hear a fair bit of disappointment in my narrative. So Sangharakshita came in, and I said, hello! And he sort of looked away and said, hello, kind of looking at the floor. And he really looked unprepossessing. Grey Mac, kind of Macintosh, long, greasy, lank hair, rather sort of bent-looking glasses. Teeth were not an advert for Indian dentistry. rough, kind of check jacket, brown trousers, and these sort of working men's boots. Very weird-looking guy, very deeply weird-looking guy. And it was really quite disconcerting, And also, I have to say, there was something distinctly odd about Sangharakshita in those days. There was a kind of wild quality. I mean, I don't mean that he'd kind of dance or anything like that. It wasn't that kind of wildness. But you felt, and maybe this was all projection. I mean, I don't mind acknowledging that. But I kind of felt anything could happen. Anything could happen around him. And it felt uncomfortable. And he was militantly himself. That was one of the things, looking back. He never, ever, in those days, I never felt put at ease. At that first meeting, I remember we had this very tiny room in this terraced house, our living room, and in the morning I found myself in this room alone with Sangharakshita. Buddhadasa was off doing something, and Sangharakshita was just sitting in this very low chair like this, just looking straight ahead, very kind of contemplative, and I made him a cup of tea, and I sat there, and okay, I was only 17, all right, you know, we can be forgiven, can't it? And I was, you know, do I make conversation? What do I say? And he certainly wasn't going to make it easy for me. He was just sitting there, being himself. There's something very real about him, and, you know, for a young, superficial, gauche, kind of callow youth, it's a little bit weird to be around, so we're sitting there. And at a certain point, he leaned over to this jam jar with incense sticks, took an incense stick out, and started to clean his ears. And my first thought was, what would Mum say? I now know, I mean, after I went and lived in India for many years, I now know that's actually quite a common thing. You sort of see people on trains, sort of, you know, don't think anything of it in India, cleaning your ears out. So that was a first encounter, and of course at that time you think, what does it mean? What does it mean? What's the teaching, you know? It seems so ridiculous now, just being himself, you know, that was the teaching, you know. I mean, years later, like at Padmaloka, you know, you sort of see the other side, you know, that, you know, kind of you do something and some, you know, a young mitra would say, why did you do that? Why did you say that? What? Why did you say that word? Why did you say hello to me in that way? Well, I was just being friendly. You know? No, there was a meaning to it, you know. No, there wasn't. I was just saying that. It's like the life of Brian, isn't it? The other thing about that first meeting with Sangharakshita, I was full of Dharma. I don't quite know what happened to me. At school, I couldn't remember anything. As soon as I read Dharma, I won't say I remembered everything that I read, but I remembered a lot. It used to really irritate order members. I'd meet order members and I'd quote the Bodhicaryavatara to them, or pages of the survey, and ask them to explain it. And they'd... You know, they'd obviously never read it. I was so irritating. And I'd go to Sangharakshita with questions like, I'd say, Panti, honest folks, is it Panti, what should I study? He said, well, what are you interested in? Well, I'm interested in the Ratnagotra Vibhaga. Well, you should study the perfection of wisdom then. Is that all? You know, aren't you going to be impressed by the fact that I can say the Sanskrit word? Things like that, but very, very, very plain. But the other thing that happened on that visit, I think it was on that visit, I was very into keeping shrines at that time, keeping them really clean and tidy, building shrines. I was very quickly into devotional practice, and I was talking to him about shrines, and we got given by the Bunty in the very early days before he'd started our movement. He was involved with the Brighton Buddhist Society. He'd go and give lectures, and a very lovely old man named Carl brought these 7 beautiful brass puja bowls that Sangharakshita had given to the Brighton Buddhist Centre. He said, "You must have these now." So I showed them to Bunty. He said, yes, they've been given to him by one of his Tibetan teachers. And he said, oh, well, if you're the shrine keeper, let me explain to you how to fill the puja bowls, how to do the ritual of filling the puja bowls. And he explained very, very carefully, very, very beautifully, how when you're pouring the water that symbolised the 7 offerings, you should recite Om Ahum. Om Ahum, Om Ahum, over and over. And you explained to me, the Om purifies the water. You imagine it, the water being purified. The Ah transforms the water bowl into a wonderful offering bowl filled with jewels and flowers and fruits and food and things like that. And then the hum, when you recite that, symbolises its emptiness, its ultimate reality. This is what he explained to me. It was a wonderful little teaching. And I was so inspired by that, I wrote up a little shrine keeper's manual, which I sent to him, which he was very, very pleased with and wanted to publish. Actually, it only came out a few years ago when I wrote it out from memory for somebody. It was one of those things that sort of got lost. And that was a sort of feature down the years of my involvement with Bhante, with Sangharakshita, that when there was a real question, a real Dharma question, in a way a real need, I'd get a very, very clear and detailed teaching. When I went to him because I wanted something that was sort of wanted attention, wanted to grasp, wanted to grab, he'd either ignore me or he'd give it so sort of reluctantly it would sort of feel tainted. It was a very, very interesting feature of my communication with him. But on that first visit, even though, you know, I wasn't able to turn him into the guru that I wanted, that I thought gurus should be, we formed a connection and we developed a correspondence and we formed a bond during that time. Okay, next thing I'll go to, related to, very strongly to spiritual friendship, is my Mitra ceremony with Sangharakshita. And in those bygone days, when you became a Mitra, you had to have two Kalyana Mitras. It's changed a bit now. You didn't just become a Mitra, you had to have two order members who would agree to be your Kalyana Mitras, your sort of special spiritual friend. I mean, eventually there were so many Mitras we had to change that system. I won't go into all the details of that now. But anyway, I asked Visantara and Buddhadasa, who were the two order members who were involved in the Brighton Centre at that time, if they'd be my Kalyana Mitras. They said yes. And they'd formed in Brighton a really lovely little sangha of men and women. You know, it's about, I guess, you know, 15 of us. Very, very lovely sangha. I think most of the people, probably all of the people, apart from me, had sort of, you know, gone away from things. But it was a very, very warm, kindly, generous community. And Sangharakshita said, look, why don't you go on retreat in Suffolk, in Thetford Forest, in a farmhouse that we used to use, and I'll do all your Kalyana Mitra ceremonies. So all of us who became Mitras had two order members to be Kalyana Mitras. And it was a wonderful weekend with Sangharakshita giving a talk about the significance of being a Mitra. And then there was the ceremony, and you went alone to Sangharakshita and with your two Kalyana Mitra order members either side of you. And I was last, because I was very definitely the youngest by a long shot. I was probably about 18 by this time. People were quite a bit older than me. And I went into the ceremony and made the offerings. And then the person, in this case Sangharakshita, gives a little discourse on the significance of becoming a Kalyana Mitra. So I sat down, you know, waiting for an inspiring, lovely discourse. He wasn't smiling. I don't know if he was tired because he'd done loads of other Kalyana Mitra ceremonies, but he didn't smile. He looked sort of a bit grim. And he said, becoming a Mitra is like joining a dance. It's like joining a dance. You've been on the outside of the dance, looking in. You've tried out a few steps, but you've been on the outside of the dance. Maybe one day you'll get to the centre of the dance, but you have to join the dance. And this is you now joining the dance. Everything's been said, everything's been thought, everything's been felt. Now is the time for action. Now is the time for doing something. And he went on and on in this way, without smiling, about action. And at the end, you know, and at the end you get blessed and all the rest of it. And I went out feeling he hates me. He really doesn't like me. I'm a bad person. And Visantara my dear Kalyana Mitra said, he didn't talk like that to anybody else. But I've never forgotten that. And actually what he was doing was saying, come on, it isn't just about reading these books and spouting all this stuff. You've got to commit. This is you committing. This is you really doing something. This is what you've got to do. And even that thing, even everything's been felt. Even feeling isn't enough. You've got to act. So I've never forgotten that particular precept. Never forgotten that one. I do remind myself of it regularly, the importance of action, of commitment. That's still an important thing. I do tend to think a lot, feel a lot, talk a lot. Where's the action? Well, don't ask. Now, we'll talk about that later. So very, very important. And I said this thing about continually, you know, Trungpa's thing about the teacher continually kind of disappointing the disciple. It's curious about some of the things where Sangharakshita at the time has been really, even quite critical of me. Actually, they've been some of the most, valuable things, you know, looking back. Is that the doorbell? Is it me? Okay. So where should we go next? So that was my Kalyana Mitra ceremony. Well, just a change approach, just by way of contrast. I'll tell you about the time when Sangharakshita told me he was going to ordain me. And I hope you're getting from this, with these sort of reminiscences, something of what a spiritual friend is like, a teacher is like, and, you know, maybe something of what a disciple is like. I mean, that's why I'm doing all this, and what Sangharakshita is like, although I find him unfathomable, really. I'll tell you about the time he told me he'd ordained me. At that, I left Brighton and moved to North London, to the infamous No. 5 Balmore Street community, which was a squat in Archway, next to the Archway Centre, in a really rough part of town. Lots of gangs of feral kids and, you know, all sorts of, you know, IRA pubs and, you know, junkie communities, Sufis and Buddhists. But a really important centre. But I'd moved there. I'd moved to that place. But I went with Sangharakshita down to Brighton. I don't quite know why, but we went down together, where he was to launch his first volume of memoirs called The Thousand Petal Lotus. And he was going to see people in Brighton. I was going to see people in Brighton. And then we'd come back together. And so we travelled down. He did this, you know, launch of this book. And the next day, where we were staying, we were having breakfast together. It was a lovely, sunny March day in this very, very bright room. Sangharakshita's sort of sartorial look was a bit different by then. It was the plum-coloured suit era. So he had a sort of plum-coloured suit and sort of reddish... Well, I don't quite know why I remember these details. Plum-coloured suit, kind of roll-neck... you know, jumper, and sort of cherry red DMs shoes before they were trendy. Head of the game, avant-garde. Anyway, we were sitting in this kitchen, and he was just sitting there. I was making tea and toast, and he looked at me with this grin and said, "By the way, I've decided to ordain you." I had asked for ordination. It wasn't that funny. Yes, I decided to ordain you. And I was just incredibly excited. And I said, well, you know, I don't know what to say. He said, well, you don't have to say anything. And then he went into this thing and said, young people have a lot to offer the order. So young in those days was 18. Old was late 20s, you know, and early 30s. And he went into this thing about, he said, look, you know, leading a Buddhist life, you don't need to go through things. And I think he was sort of heading off some of the things that people were saying to me, that basically, because I was so young and naive and inexperienced, you know, I hadn't had heartbreak yet. Well, I had, but in an unrequited sort of way. Quite a few order members, in a way, didn't take me very seriously. Yeah, fair enough. But he was saying, you know, you don't have to go through things to commit yourself to a Buddhist life, probably knowing full well that, you know, I would go through things. And it's just incredibly encouraging. And, you know, when you're that age and you're if you like, your spiritual aspiration is, and confidence isn't that, it's not that great really, at that age. I mean, I was very, very lacking in confidence. To hear someone you have enormous respect for say that to you really means something. I am conscious in talking about all this that you might be sort of wondering, what was Padmavajra's relationship like with his father? Is there some massive father projection going on? I had a wonderful relationship with my dad, by the way, just to say. Very, very close. So it wasn't, there was a sort of father surrogate going on here. Anyway, I was absolutely delighted that he said he'd ordain me. He said, you know, we'll do it in the summer sometime. And there was a very weird experience I had of Sangharakshita going back on the last train from Brighton to Victoria. Really slow train. And he didn't want to talk, obviously. And, you know, he wanted to look at some of the books he'd got from the second-hand bookshops. So he handed me a book to read. I dozed off. And every so often I'd kind of wake up on this train. And Sangharakshita was sitting kind of like this on the seat in front of me, kind of looking at me with this really strange, weird, delighted, kind of mysterious expression, very enigmatic. So I kind of, you know, I wake up every so often and there's this face kind of looking at me. I have no idea what was going on, absolutely no idea what there was, but there was some strange kind of communication. You know, we got home and, you know, that was it. And then there was I won't go to my ordination retreat. I'll go to my my first study seminar with Sangharakshita, which was on a weekend on the Mangala Sutta, which is a really wonderful short sutta from the Pali Canon, which he expounded with it's just wonderful sitting in study with Sangharakshita with this English translation, and he's referring to the Pali and drawing out the entire Buddhist tradition. And very interesting, one of the little teachings that I've never forgotten from weekend, and it was one of the first time I'd heard about Sufism, which I'd developed quite an interest in over the years. Actually, Sangharakshita sparked that off. He was talking about the importance of spiritual friendship, how important it is to be with people who encourage you in your Dharma life, who support you in your Dharma life. It's one of the mangalas, one of the lucky signs, the auspicious signs that the Buddha says you need to have in your life. And he said that, okay, supposing you aren't able to be with a spiritual friend, or somebody asked the question, but supposing you can't be with a spiritual friend, what then? He said, this reminds me of a Sufi story. Once there was a Sufi, and he had to leave his sheikh, his peer. And he dearly didn't want to leave his peer. He had to go far away. He loved being with his teacher, loved being with his sheikh, really in touch with, you know, the Sufi path. A very intense relationship that, you know, tradition fosters. But he had to go off. So he said to his teacher, "What shall I do? What shall I do without you?" And the teacher said, "Create the man you need. Create the person that you need." So Sangharakshita was saying, okay, if you can't be with your spiritual friends, communicate in such a way to people so that you turn them into the spiritual friends that you need. In other words, teach the Dharma, communicate the Dharma. And Anusubhuti, your president, has been saying lately that you know, if you're in non-Buddhist environments of various kinds, do what you can to transform that. Create the people that you need in that environment. Obviously very skillfully, very tactfully. Don't sort of ram Buddhism down people's throats. But befriend people in such a way that they start turning into your spiritual friends. So I never forgot that in a particular teaching, well, it's a Sufi teaching, but Sangharakshita picked it out. Beget the man you need. Beget the person you need. Create the person that you need. So that was a that was an important time. There was another one as well on that particular retreat, which is very pertinent. Lokamitra, who'd become another Kalyana Mitra, a close friend of mine, started things off in India. He was saying, in the Mangala Sutta, it says staying in a delightful place, a place conducive to Dharma life, Dharma practice. And Lokamitra was saying, yes, sometimes I do feel I need to get away from Archway to this centre we had in North London and go to the countryside and go up to Hampstead Heath and things like this. And before he could sort of finish speaking, Sangharakshita sort of burst into, I've been reading Harquin recently, the great Zen master, and Harquin says, you make the most spiritual progress when things are difficult, when it's noisy, when you're in a dirty place with difficult people, when you're ill, then you make the most spiritual progress. And there's sort of Lokamitra sort of, alright, I get the message, I get the message. Again, another very pertinent little teaching, really, little precept. You know that sometimes the difficult places, the difficult situations, actually draw out something much deeper in us. So you kind of need both. Yes, you need your spiritual friends, but you also need to test yourself as well. And certainly, I felt that after I was ordained, I was very much tested in a way. Up to ordination was a sort of, it really was a kind of love affair that I was involved with, culminating in my ordination, which was on a weekend retreat. Again, another little bizarre story. Sangharakshita, I don't know what was going on, but I think sometimes Sangharakshita did like to play. I think he was... You know, some of his teachers were into sort of leela, into play, just this sort of very light way of approaching life. I mean, Sangharakshita, has got a sort of slightly wicked sense of humour. Anyway, so one day I was at number 5 Balmore Street in my little room, and Dharma Dina, who's associated with this centre now, she was the secretary of our centre in North London then. She came round and she said, Bhante wants to talk to you, he's on the phone, come round to the centre, because we didn't have phones then, I mean, we didn't even have landlines, it was a landline at the centre that somebody had sort of lashed up, I don't know how legally that was, but anyway, we had something. So, I thought, crikey, but Bhante didn't have a phone, so Bhante, I knew then, was in a call box in a village in North Norfolk, because in those days Bhante lived in this village called Castle Acre in North Norfolk, didn't have a phone. So there's Bhante in a call box phoning our centre in Archway. So I get to the phone, Bhante comes on the line and says, hello, I've got Padmaraja with me, who was a very prominent order member. Unfortunately he left the order under not very easy circumstances, but he was a very important order member to us young mitras in those days. Padmaraja's with me. So there's Bhante and Padmaraja in this telephone box, red telephone box, I'd seen it, in Castle Acre, in North Norfolk. He's got an important message for you. Padmaraja, very intense guy, said, you and Gary have got to be at number 5 next Friday at 1 o'clock. Cancel all other appointments. Here's Bhante. Bhante, you've got the message. Bye. Weird situation. So me and Gary, who became Ratnaguna, who some of you might know, we're sitting in the kitchen at number 5. Padmaraja appears and he hands us 2 Basildon Bond envelopes, these kind of little, very neat envelopes with our names on them. And we open them up, and Sangharakshita is this little note, after consulting the order members who know you, I've decided to ordain you, to conduct your ordination into the Western Buddhist Order. You can either be ordained later on in the summer at our new retreat centre, which is Padmaloka, or next weekend in Thetford Forest. And we both looked at each other and said, next weekend! We weren't going to hang around, we might... you know, something might happen between now and June, so in now and August, so next weekend. And it was a magic weekend. It's curious, I was 19 by then, and it's curious that something happening when you're 19 actually is the sort of centre of your life. It's a very weird thing to say, but I think I can say that now, 56 now. But that was a sort of major turning point in my life, which I continually refer to. I mentioned Alred of Rivo saying that friendship should have a quality of eternity to it. Well, in a way, I felt that my ordination had a kind of quality of eternity to it. People experience ordination in very different ways. But for me, it was extraordinarily vivid. For a start, Sangharakshita really, I mean, literally dressed up for the occasion. I mean, he used to wear his robes in those days. Very important for, you know, he wore the traditional robes of a Buddhist monk, but he had long hair and wore beads, you know, which, you know, that's kind of crunching the sort of boundaries, which I really liked, you know, this slightly sort of rebellious kind of quality. You know, what is he? Is he a monk? Is he not a monk? What is he? I like that. You know, that's very important. You know, the sort of smashing, the kind of ecclesiastical boundaries. I think that I, you know, generally approve of that. Maybe I should kind of do something with my case there. Anyway. Yeah. But not only did he wear his robes, he had on this fantastic Tibetan shirt, this sort of orangey gold Chinese silk embossed with dragons, high collared Tibetan shirt with very sort of long sleeves. And he sort of appeared very regally, you know, with this long hair, and he had these beads. And Lokamitra, who was, you know, was very chatty with Bhante, said, "Oh, Bhante, you know, you're really getting dressed up for the occasion." And he said, "Ah, well, because Richard, that was my name, because he's into things Tibetan, I thought I ought to dress up." Sort of eyes flashing and... And he had these beads. He had these beads, these sort of brown beads with every 20... Well, you know, brown with, and every so often there were these white beads. So I said, "What about the beads, Bhante? What about the rosary you've got there?" He said, He said, "Well, these beads were given me by Mr. Chen." Mr. Chen was this Chinese hermit who was one of Sangharakshita's teachers, very important teacher, Mr. Chen. I mean, even the name kind of tingles down your spine. And he said, "They're moon and stars beads because they've got these, you know, they've got the sort of pattern of the moon and the star on the beads." I said, "Yeah, but what about the white beads?" And he said, "Ah, they're every 27 beads for certain practices." So, wow, certain practices, you know. So, he really knew what he was doing with me. He was really sort of playing me. Very, very playful. He's one of the most playful people that I know, actually. The sort of play your way to enlightenment. But and then the ordination itself. I won't go into that, but something happened. Something happened, particularly to do with the mantra initiation and the name giving. Something definitely happened. Something sort of extraordinarily vivid happened. A kind of connection was made with him and with the divine spiritual guide that I was introduced to, that but has never been broken in that time, and which continues to grow. Many years later, and I've been thinking about this recently after some discussions with Subhuti. Bhante made us aware of it, made Subhuti and I aware of it, that Lama Govinda describes the spiritual friend as what the spiritual friend does, what the spiritual friend gives, is the flashing forth of the cosmogonic eros. The flashing forth of the cosmogonic eros. I think this is something from Gnosticism or Neoplatonism. It's something to do with the whole creation of the world in that mythology. That cosmogonic means the creation of a cosmos out of chaos. And it's done by eros. It's done out of love. It's done out of love. And that's what a spiritual friend really does. That's what a great teacher does in relation to a disciple. Out of their love of the Dharma, out of their love of the disciple, they introduce them to this creation of a world through... They introduce you to something which can create a world of meaning and of value. And I felt that what Sangharakshita gave me with the mantra initiation and the practices associated with that was a way in which I kind of create this world of spiritual unfoldment and development, which I'm still growing into. And of course, with a creation, there also has to be a kind of death as well. But something extraordinarily vital was transmitted, and being named was extraordinarily important. And again, it was like being given everything I'd always wanted, really, being called Padmavajra. He said immediately it was one of the names of the great teacher Padmasambhava, which he recognised that I had a devotion to. But at the public ordination, he said that it was all about the importance of the balance, if not the balance, but the harmonising of the lotus and the vajra, the lotus being the soft, kindly, unfolding, more feminine qualities, and the vajra being the hard, cutting, energetic, more masculine qualities. He said they should be both perfectly fused. They should be two in one. And there's a real sort of precept there, which obviously I'm still still working on in whatever way I can. But I really felt it was, I suppose you could say it was being, the ordination weekend was being given vision. Vision being sparked off by the teacher. Sparked off by the teacher. I don't think he was conscious of doing that. Sangharakshita is always just himself. He was just responding to what was happening. He was just doing what needed to be done in relation to me and Ratnaguna and the other people there. But for me, it was a definite sparking off. It was like being put in touch with a very, very powerful current of sort of electricity, even a kind of thunderbolt. Also on that weekend, he led a seminar. Not only did he do two private ordinations, a public ordination, he led us all in a seminar on the shepherd's search for mind, with the first half of which is a sort of savage kind of critique of the world and everything goes with it by Milarepa. I mean, if you think, you know, some of the Buddhas and even Sangharakshita's sort of critique of society is a bit heavy, read Milarepa. I mean, this is really kind of savage, you know, everything gets sort of taken to bits. The second half is all about this young 16-year-old shepherd who Milarepa shows the nature of mind, the nature of bodhicitta, the nature of enlightened mind, the nature of pure, non-dual, fresh, luminous awareness. And when Sangharakshita expounded this, you felt that he was doing it to you. You felt that he was kind of showing the nature of that enlightened consciousness. We felt that was kind of happening. You were kind of seeing it. You were being shown it. I mean, I can't tell you what that was. It was all highly kind of intuitive and thrilling. So there was a real electricity to that weekend. And interestingly enough, I came. So that was a weekend retreat. came back from that weekend retreat. And that night, in my tiny little room at number 5, which, and I was sharing a room with Visantra, who was lying on the floor next to me. And this little room that I had was just full of reproductions of Tibetan tankas. Basically, I was living in a shrine room, a tiny shrine room. And many of them were of Padmasambhava. And there was one opposite my bed of Padmasambhava on the glorious copper-covered mountain. And right in the middle of the night, in a sort of semi-waking state, it was as if a thunderbolt was coming from that tanka, coming from that painting. And that thunderbolt was going to destroy me. Yeah. Utterly. Completely. And I hauled myself out of this dream state into jabbering consciousness, shaking the Santa awake and coming awake with the words, "It's the picture, it's the picture." And at the time I thought, wow, weird dream, that's cosmic. But actually it was a kind of prophecy, I think, because in a way things got extremely difficult after that. You know, after that, I think I didn't really work out what I'd done until that was 76, until about 14 years later. I think I worked out what I'd done in becoming an order member when I moved to Padmaloka in 1990 and became part of the ordination team there. It was only then, I think, that I really worked out what I'd done, or I began to work out what I'd done. I mean, when you get ordained, it won't be like that for you. I mean, because, you know, because we've done all this hard work, when you get ordained, you'll get so well trained, it'll be really easy. It's a joke, actually. But it just sort of showed me that what Sangharakshita had put me in touch with, yes, was, you know, extraordinarily uplifting and inspiring, but also very destructive. In the end, very destructive, and there was going to have to be a lot of work to integrate it. It isn't just about spiritual rebirth. I think it's the year of spiritual rebirth here, isn't it, of being reborn. You know, spiritual rebirth comes after spiritual death. And actually, there was another sort of poem I copied. I've copied different things of Sangharakshita, and I love this bit. This is from On Glastonbury Tour, actually. And there's just this little bit, which goes, "Oh, but what if there were nothing to understand, nothing to learn? What if we had simply to accept incomprehension, accept defeat, accept collapse, disintegration, death, face dissolution of the mind, abdication of reason, erasure of what can be weighed, numbered, measured, sensed, known, face descent into hell without hope of resurrection on the third day? Are we prepared for this?" That's what he means, actually, by spiritual death. It's not just a sort of little bit dropping away. It is actual, total transformation. So that's what I was being introduced to. I've got to finish at 9:45, and it's now 2:16. So, shall I end there?
Tempted to say no, don't stop.
Invite me back.
Well,
I'll do the other bit. I'll do
carry
the...
on till midnight. Can't we? So, I mean, Padmaraja, what a incredible just the evening with something, just a glimpse of what Padmaraja can offer. He talked about being sparked off by Sangharakshita. He talked about this current that he was introduced to. Padmaraja has that spark, and he's introduced many, many, many people. He's ordained many, many men, publicly and privately, and he's sparked people off, and he continues to do that. I feel that we've had a touch of that tonight, and even a touch of that is well worth cherishing. So I feel very, very grateful to Padmaraja for all sorts of things, and particularly at the moment for tonight. So thank you very, very much, Padmaraja. And yes, I really welcome you back. I really urge you to come again and carry on. It's still only about 19.
Yeah, I know. There's got lots of other bits, and there might be, you know, I just sort of realised that could be a bit heavy, that last bit.
No, it's good to finish with spiritual bit.
Good, okay.
It's great. So, from another round of you can stay, I mean, it just feels appropriate to do a puja now. If you can stay, you're very, very welcome to. In a way, round off Dharma Day with a devotional ritual.